Chapter 24, A Dangerous Passage. Do you recognize your staff's achievements so long after the event that even they forget? We learn not to let admin get in the way. July 10, 1999, the Strait of Malacca. Santa Fe was on the surface, transiting westward through the Strait of Malacca. It's a tough transit. More than 160 large vessels, nearly half the world's oil tankers, pass through the strait every day. Because it is shallow, any submarine must transit on the surface, an unnatural and uncomfortable place to be. After all, a submarine is designed not to be seen, and our speed is slower on the surface than it is submerged. Near Singapore, ferries and tugs with tows create significant cross-traffic between Singapore and Indonesia. Finally, the gap between the east and westbound maritime traffic lanes was full of small fishing boats, sometimes no larger than a paddleboard, that wandered into the main traffic lane from time to time. Our plan for making the difficult three-day passage was to tuck in 1,000 yards behind one of the large westbound, empty oil tankers and draft in its shadow like a cyclist in the Tour de France. Ships would avoid the large, easy-to-see tanker, and we'd get a clear path. The trick was to get close enough not to let other traffic close in behind the tanker, but at the same time maintain a safe distance. I split the time with my new executive officer, Lieutenant Commander Tom Stanley, on the bridge. I'd be up there for 12 hours, then he would drive the ship. I took the night shift. On the first night, as we were passing the lights of Singapore to our starboard, I noticed a dim light moving across us. While I was trying to figure out what it meant, Rick Panlilio, the officer of the deck, shouted, "All back emergency, right hard rudder." Immediately, the ship started shuddering as the throttleman back in maneuvering shut the ahead throttles and rapidly opened the astern throttles, reversing the main engines and Santa Fe screw. The light was a dimly lit tugboat, and the tug was on one side of our path and its tow on the other. We barely stopped short of the tow line between the tug and the barge. I was shaken. I came down off the bridge and went directly to maneuvering to applaud the efforts of the engineering team. The petty officer who had pushed the red tag aside in the shore power incident was the throttleman. He had spared us from a collision. It was 0515 and the watch team was about to get relieved. I grabbed YN1 Scott Dillon, who maintained the supply of awards, and asked him to get me a Navy Achievement Medal. With it, I returned to the crew's mess and pinned it on the throttleman while he and the off-going watch team ate breakfast. I spoke words of appreciation and professionalism. Later, I would formally report this exemplary service, but the immediacy of the recognition was important. Mechanism: use immediate recognition to reinforce desired behaviors. We let our administrative processes get in the way of prompt recognition. Many times we would submit awards 3 months prior to the departure of a sailor, only to find ourselves calling during the last week to track down the award before his departure. When I say immediate recognition, I mean immediate, not 30 days, not 30 minutes, immediate. Look at the structure for awards. Are they limited? Do they pit some of your employees against others? That structure will result in competition at the lowest level. If what you want is collaboration, then you're destroying it. Instead, have awards that are abundant, with no limit. They pit your team against the world, either external competitors or nature. I like to call these man versus nature as opposed to man versus man awards. Every team that can get a fire hose to the scene of the fire within 2 minutes gets an award. The award could be a superior grade. In cases where there is a physical reason for the goal, this is better than, say, having the top 10% of the shortest times get an excellent. On the one hand, it's possible that the best times are 3 minutes, and you are handing out excellence to a team that would actually die in a fire. On the other hand, once the team has gotten better than 2 minutes, you don't need them to spend more time and energy honing that skill. Better to move to another problem area. The most important change that happens, however, is that all teams, in our case all submarines, are now collaborators, working against a common external goal as opposed to competitors working against one another. One of the things I tried to change was the collaboration-competition boundary. When I got to Santa Fe, people within the ship were competing with one another. department heads for the top fitness report, FitRep spot, nukes against supply for blame on who didn't order the part, and so on, we deliberately pushed that boundary to the skin of the ship. We'd say, there is no they on Santa Fe. We wanted cooperation within the ship and the competition to be against the other submarines, or better yet, the potential enemy. Use immediate recognition to reinforce desired behaviors is a mechanism for clarity. Some people worry that having a fixed objective reduces the incentive for continuous improvement and breeds a mentality that we just need to meet the goal. In some cases, this is appropriate, but in other cases, relative grading is also appropriate. There's no reason you can't do both. Assign the grade based on the fixed objective and provide data on how the team stacks up against all teams. Simply providing data to the teams on their relative performance results in a natural desire to improve. This has been called gamification. The blog to read more about this is Gabe Zuckerman's gamification blog, www.gamification.co. Questions to consider. Do you have a recognition and reward system in place that allows you to immediately applaud top performers? How can you create scoring systems that immediately reward employees for the behaviors you want? Have you seen evidence of gamification in your workplace? Perhaps it's worth reading one of Gabe Zuckerman's blog posts and discussing it with your management team. Chapter 25, Looking Ahead. Are you mired in short-term thinking? For me, it was tough to start thinking beyond the next inspection, but it paid off. July 15th, 1999, Indian Ocean. I mentioned that we deployed 2 weeks earlier than originally scheduled. We were able to accomplish that because of a conversation I had with Lieutenant Dave Adams about 3 months prior. At the time, we were on track to be ready for deployment. The crew was adapting well to the many changes we'd made, and he earnestly wanted to get them some time off before we left our families behind for the six-month deployment. We were scheduled to depart for the Western Pacific and the Arabian Gulf on June 29th. In that time, we had myriad things to fix and equipment to load, including missiles and torpedoes, all of which had to be checked. We were also scheduled to return to San Diego for a second set of battle group exercises, a tactical inspection, and the final certification for our deployment. I appreciated what Weps was saying. In the scheduling books, all ships showed a pre-deployment stand-down in the 2 weeks prior to deployment, but it was effectively just an accounting tool so the staff could say the ship had stand-down. In reality, that period was crammed with frenetic activity and no one had any time off. By beginning with the end in mind, however, we should be able to do something about negotiating at least part of that stand-down period for the crew. Following up on Dave's goal, we got the department heads and chiefs together and looked at the schedule. The only way we would be able to give the crew 2 weeks off in June, just before we deployed, would be if we were completely ready for deployment 2 weeks early. This would be tough because the external organizations, the weapons loading facility, and the Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard, would know they actually had another 2 weeks to finalize preparations, and work would slip into that period. Internally, the department heads would need to have the ship ready in all respects on June 8th, a full 3 weeks before the scheduled deployment date. I would personally approve all exceptions for any work planned after that date. It would be a tall order and was met with groans of impossibility. Against that backdrop, however, we talked about what would be achieved, a true stand-down where we could spend time with our families before the six-month deployment. It was my job to notify external parties, the squadron and the repair facility primarily, that we had drawn a line in the sand and Santa Fe needed to be ready in all respects on June 8th. We put the word out to the crew and started figuring out how to be ready on our target date. Then, at the end of April, with about 6 weeks to go, Commodore Mark Kenney called me. The nation needed us to deploy 11 days early on June 18th. Well, we could and we did. It was only because we were already working on our plan for being ready 3 weeks early that it was possible. Unfortunately, we did lose much of the family time we'd hoped for. We would have a short stand down, the nation needed us, and we would deliver. Mechanism, begin with the end in mind. We had started a new practice. Now I wanted to build on the success of that practice. I decided that one key supervisor a day, rotating among the executive officer, chief of the boat, weapons officer, navigator, engineer, and supply officer, would have an hour-long mentoring session with me. The rule for the mentoring meeting was that we could talk only about long-term issues, and primarily people issues. All business concerning a leaking valve or failed circuit card had to occur outside these meetings. During the first set of discussion, we adapted a useful technique for long-term focus and planning. I asked each of them to write their end-of-tour awards. Since these supervisors are assigned to the submarine for 3 years, this particular exercise made them look that far into the future. If someone was having trouble visualizing that far out, I asked him to write his performance evaluation for the next year. Lieutenant Commander Bill Green would be transferring in a few months, but Lieutenant Commander Tom Stanley, Lieutenant Dave Adams, and Lieutenant Commander Rick Panlilio weren't leaving for another 2 years. I wanted this to be a serious exercise. I wouldn't let them turn in a quick response. I assigned it as homework between two mentoring sessions a week apart. Then we would look at the write-up together. When we looked at Dave's end-of-tour award write-up, I noted he had some great ideas. It struck me that I had entered this mentoring practice with the idea of a traditional mentor-mentee relationship and hadn't realized the incompatibility of that hierarchy with leader-leader. I learned as much from them as they did from me. Hence, we were practicing a mentor-mentor program. Dave and I discussed each one of his goals and made it as specific and measurable as possible. Dave made a plan to accomplish each of the things in the write-up, spaced over the next 2 years. He was going to get two fitness reports over those 2 years as well, and we applied the same approach to the fit reps, making goals measurable and setting in place the tools to collect the data. 2 years later, when Dave transferred off Santa Fe, his department had accomplished almost everything he'd written down, and the actual citation sounded just like our vision. Frequently, we would start off by writing about achieving certain levels of qualification, as in qualify for command, or having general goals for their team, such as have my department do better in procedural compliance. Objectives like these are too vague and hard to quantify, so we would work to write the objective in measurable ways. We'd arrive at the specifics by asking a question such as, how would you know if procedural compliance was improved? We'd have fewer critiques. Okay, how many fewer? How many did you have last year? Don't know, didn't count. In this way, we generated verifiable measures, and in the process, we often learned that we hadn't been keeping track of the appropriate data, and we'd have to start doing so. The Navy's performance system is deliberately constructed to make the highest comparative rankings scarce. Since we had three department heads and one executive officer on Santa Fe who were all of the rank lieutenant or lieutenant commander, they were competing against one another. As a result, it is difficult to get all of them promoted because only one will get the top recommendation. We were able to get everyone promoted and had tremendous success with bigger groups like the first class petty officer evaluations as well. Customarily, selection boards read performance evaluations that are filled with phrases like significantly improved procedural compliance, which are basically meaningless. The evaluation of the officers on Santa Fe, on the other hand, would report reduced critiques by 43%, reduced percent of the crew smoking by 12%, increased on-time performance by 31%, and so on. I believe the ability to specifically quantify accomplishments, in addition to the focus this exercise required of the officers and the overall reputation of the ship, went a long way toward allowing us to boast disproportionately high selection rates. During my last year in command, 2001, we had 10 men eligible to be promoted from first class petty officer to chief petty officer. We had an amazing 90% selection rate, promoting 9 chiefs. In one day, the number of chiefs almost doubled, and then they transferred to other boats. It was gratifying to see YN1 Scott Dillon, whom I met as a second-class petty officer when I reported on board, make chief. Using hard data was an effective way of proving we had achieved the end we had in mind. How to begin with the end in mind. Here are some things you can do to begin with the end in mind. Hand out this chapter as reading material. Also consider Stephen Covey's The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, Chapter 2, Begin with the End in Mind. Discuss the concepts and idea of Begin with the End in Mind. With your leadership team, develop long-term organizational goals for 3 to 5 years out. Go through the evaluations and look for statements that express achievement. In every case, ask, how would we know? And ensure that you have measuring systems in place. Then, have employees write their own evaluations 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years hence. The goals in the employee's evaluations should cascade down from the organization's goals. They needn't necessarily be identical, but they should be appropriate at an individual level. Have conversations with employees to make their desired achievements indisputable, how would I know, and measurable. While the end of tour awards write-up exercise was beneficial because it forced each officer to get clear in his own mind what he wanted to achieve, it also opened the way to helpful dialogue. In my dialogues with each supervisor, I discussed what I was trying to accomplish on Santa Fe, and collectively, they were able to translate that to what they needed to accomplish within their departments in order to support the higher-level goals. These discussions, during which we talked at length about the recursive goals and accomplishments, were very beneficial. Begin with the end in mind is an important mechanism for organizational clarity. As you work with individuals in your organization to develop their vision of the future, it is crucial that you establish specific, measurable goals. These goals will help the individuals realize their ambitions. In addition, you as a mentor have to establish that you are sincerely interested in the problems of the person you are mentoring. By taking action to support the individual, you will prove that you are indeed working in their best interest and always keeping the end in mind. Questions to consider. For how far in the future are you optimizing your organization? Are you mentoring solely to instruct or also to learn? Will you know if you've accomplished your organizational and personal goals? Are you measuring the things you need to be? Have you assigned a team to write up the company's goals 3 to 5 years out? What will it take to redesign your management team's schedule so you can mentor one another? How can you reward staff members who attain their measurable goals? Chapter 26, Combat Effectiveness. Are you looking for resilience in your organization? We realized that resilience and effectiveness sometimes meant questioning orders. September 1999, somewhere in the Arabian Gulf. Upscope, in the shallow water of the Arabian Gulf, we were setting up an attack on another submarine, the USS Olympia, which was playing an enemy diesel boat. We were halfway through our deployment period and were about to shoot the first ever submarine-launched torpedo in the Arabian Gulf. It was an exercise, and the target was Ole. This was the submarine I was originally ordered to command, you might recall. We had the commander, Submarine Group 7, Rear Admiral Joseph Kroll, on board to observe the exercise. Admiral Kroll had allowed me to send Rick Panlilio home for the birth of his child and approve the early swap of Lieutenant Commander Tom Stanley as executive officer. It would be important to show the Admiral he'd made the right decision. The pressure was on. This was going to be the test of leader-leader versus leader-follower. Would the mechanisms I'd put in place deliver the kind of results I'd hoped for? We were in position, and I was sure no one would be asking to raise the communications mast this time. So far, so good. Just like the Maui Basin, the water in the Arabian Gulf is shallow, and we needed to be in a good tactical position. We were demonstrating not only the capabilities of the USS Santa Fe, but more important, the United States Submarine Force's ability to attack and sink submarines in this shallow body of water. We wanted any potential adversaries to know that they weren't safe here or anywhere, and instead of making speeches, we were demonstrating it. Target, bearing, mark. Lieutenant Commander Rick Penlilly was on the scope and saw the enemy. Downscope. Lieutenant Commander Tom Stanley, the executive officer, announced that we had a firing solution, and Lieutenant Dave Adams recommended we shoot. I didn't have to drive the problem and was able to sit back and absorb the whole scene, walking from station to station, looking at the faces and posture of the men in the fire control party. I ordered, "Shoot tube 3!" A shutter, and the exercise torpedo was on its way. "Torpedo running hot, straight and normal," was the WEPS's report. Officially, we were supposed to say, "Wire clearance maneuver complete, torpedo running," but we'd changed our language to match what the World War II submariners said. Again, this was an example of our mechanism to tap our rich heritage. I looked over at Admiral Kroll, and he seemed to be enjoying himself, a good sign. The exercise torpedo signaled a hit. I announced it on the 1MC to cheers. The torpedo would now surface, and a supporting craft with a crane would haul it out of the water and back to shore for refurbishment. I headed down to the crew's mess for a cup of coffee. The mess was packed with damage control parties conducting training. Admiral Kroll came down and presided over a reenlistment ceremony. Since we were in a combat zone, the bonuses we awarded sailors when they reenlisted were tax-free. Ultimately, we would reenlist 36 sailors in 1999, 12 times the number who reenlisted in 1998. I would award more than $500,000 in reenlistment bonuses, a record then. Leader had paid off again. December 1999, somewhere in the Pacific. "Yellow sounding," was announced over the ship's loudspeaker. I was walking the ship with my flashlight and bolted for the control room. It was 0300, and we were carefully positioned to pick up a SEAL team coming out from land nearby. It had taken a lot to get to this point, and now we were about to muck it all up. Yellow sounding meant the water depth was less than we'd planned, and we needed to move. It was nearly a year into my tour as the captain of Santa Fe. We were back from deployment and conducting an exercise with the SEALs. We were in the last of three phases. For phase one, we rendezvoused with the helicopter and picked up the SEAL team. 11 burly guys, their weapons, 2 rolled-up Zodiac inflatable boats, 2 motors for the Zodiacs, and a bunch of equipment to blow stuff up left the helicopter, came on board the submarine, and went down the hatch. The helicopter flew away. Total elapsed time, less than a minute. Together with the SEAL team, we planned the mission for Phase 2. We transited near the location and scoped it out. We noticed where the shore lights were, where the fishing boats were, and, more important, where they weren't. We checked local currents and the angle of the moon at various times in the night. After finding a good drop-off and recovery point, we surfaced at night and launched the SEALs toward the beach. That had been 3 days earlier. Now it was time to pick them up, Phase 3. I imagined being one of those SEALs, having successfully accomplished the mission, getting back into the Zodiac and heading out into the ocean in the middle of the night, hoping to find the submarine. Even though this was an exercise, the ocean was real. The near-empty gas tanks were real, and the darkness was real. It was important that we were in position for these guys. It was pitch black in the control room. We wanted to keep it dark inside so that the periscope operator could see outside. The speakers from our early warning receiver were chirping away. These are pulses from other radars that are being intercepted by our equipment and are translated to this audible tone. By the characteristic of the chirps, regular of a certain tone, I could tell they were indicating regular fishing boats and merchants in the distance, nothing to worry about. Reports were coming into the control room from different parts of the ship. Readiness to pick up the SEALs, the status of other contacts also confirmed we were all set. Things seemed to be going well. I passed through the crew's mess, one deck below the control room. Here, the lights were on and blankets were stacked in piles in case they were needed. Even though it was 3 o'clock in the morning, the crew was still ready to serve these guys soup as soon as they arrived on board. After the crew's mess is the escape trunk. This is the main hatch that we would open to allow the SEALs to come down into the ship. This is where we would triage any injured SEALs. Beyond that, I passed into the engine room, where the nukes were ready to provide maximum propulsion, even though we were sitting at all stop right now on the surface. The nuclear reactor was still running to provide us electric power and steam in case we needed it. If something happened, if a patrol craft or an enemy airplane came by, and we had to make a choice between getting out of there and leaving the SEALs or saving the ship, we were going to save the ship. It was important to plan, to pick the right location. Forward, in the lower level, in the torpedo room, torpedoes were loaded and ready. We didn't expect trouble, but we were prepared to face it. The wardroom, where the officers eat, was set up like an operating room by Doc Hill. This was where he would deal with any injured SEALs. Now, here's the thing. Almost none of these preparations had happened because of my orders. They happened because someone on the crew thought, hey, those guys are going to be wet. They're going to be cold. They're going to be hungry. They might be injured, and we should get ready for them. My crew didn't wait for orders. They just did what needed to be done and informed the appropriate personnel. It was leader, leader all the way. That's when the yellow sounding was announced. Mechanism. Encourage a questioning attitude over blind obedience. I entered the control room, where things were strangely calm. Surely my guys knew that if we moved out of position, it would make it much harder for us to find the SEALs and for them to find us. The officer of the deck on the bridge had already ordered ahead 1/3. I looked at the digital chart. A little arrow indicated our direction of motion, and it was pointing slightly toward the beach. I thought, we don't want to go ahead. We need to back out. So I shouted out, that's wrong. We need to back. This meant order a backing bell. In the darkness, we recognized each other's voice. Sled Dog was standing quartermaster. There was a pause and silence for half a second. Then he said frankly, no, Captain, you're wrong. It stunned me, and I shut up and just started looking at the indications in the control room, including the compass repeater showing the heading of the ship. I thought about what it takes for a young sailor to say, Captain, you're wrong. It dawned on me. The bow was pointing away from land, and we were being set astern. That was what the arrow on the digital chart was showing, and I remembered that the watch team had planned it this way, with the bow out, in case we needed to make a quick getaway. The small arrow shrank and grew in the direction away from land. The officer of the deck ordered all stop. We'd moved 100 yards, but that was all it took to reach deeper water. Moments later, we saw the Zodiacs. Had the men followed my order, we would have gone in the wrong direction. We might have missed them. As I read this, the news is filled with the tragedy in Italy. On January 13, 2012, the cruise ship Costa Concordia ran aground off Isola di Giglio. It appears the captain ordered a course deviation to take the ship close to the island as a nautical tribute to one of the employees. I wonder if anyone spoke up. How about the officer of the deck? How about the second in command? How about the helmsman, who must have seen the lights of the island less than a mile away? I sure wish some of them had a questioning attitude. Encourage a questioning attitude over blind obedience is a mechanism for clarity. Questions to consider. How do we create resilient organizations where errors are stopped as opposed to propagating through the system? Will your people follow an order that isn't correct? Do you want obedience or effectiveness? Have you built a culture that embraces a questioning attitude? Chapter 27, Homecoming. Do you have the fortitude to go against the grain? There are significant benefits to thinking differently about leadership. January 2000, at anchor off Lahaina, Maui. We were thrilled to get back from deployment before Christmas and be reunited with our families. After the holidays, we got underway for a short period in the Hawaiian Islands for proficiency training. I had already been using some of Dr. Stephen Covey's material from Seven Habits, so when he expressed the desire to ride a submarine, it was a natural fit for him to come ride Santa Fe. During his visit on board the Santa Fe, Dr. Covey asked me what the ship had accomplished. I ticked off the following list of accomplishments. We steamed 40,000 miles safely. We made 9 port calls in 6 different countries, and the crew had acted as perfect ambassadors. We hadn't had a single Liberty incident, something that I was reminded to avoid by my various bosses prior to the arrival of every port visit. We maintained the submarine at 100% operational readiness with 0 operational impact due to repair, maintenance personnel, or any other issue. While on deployment, we reenlisted 19 crew members for a total of more than $500,000 in reenlistment bonuses, a record at the time. We awarded 22 submarine qualifications, Dolphins, and the crew qualified 290 individual watch stations, an average of 2.4 qualifications for each crew member. Operationally, we had demonstrated some key capabilities, including our torpedo exercise in the Arabian Gulf, transiting the Strait of Hormuz several times and the Strait of Malacca twice, and picking up the U.S. Navy SEALs. Of course, there were some things I couldn't tell them about. To my mind, the most impressive statistic was the improvement in our retention results. The numbers came out like this. Enlisted reenlistments in 1998, 3. In 1999, 36. Officer retention, 1998, 0%. 1999, 100%. Enlisted personnel selected for officer programs, 1998, 1. 1999, 3. Enlisted personnel advanced, 1998, 30. 1999, 48. Personnel determined to be ineligible for reenlistment, a bad thing. 1998, 8. 1999, 1. Average weeks to qualify in submarines, 1998, 45. 1999, 38. Enlisted contact coordinators, 1998, 1. 1999, 8. E6 qualified diving officers, 1998, 0. 1999, 2. Port and starboard watch stations, 1998, 7, 1999, 0. Engineering assessment, 1998, below average, 1999, above average. Training program effectiveness, 1998, not effective, 1999, very effective. Medical assessment, 1998, worst of 6 in Squadron 7, 1999, best of 6 in Squadron 7. Contact coordination, 1998, below average, 1999, excellent. Tactical effectiveness in various mission areas, 1998, below average to average, 1999, above average to excellent. Why had the retention numbers gone up so much? Well, there were a couple of reasons, but one of the key ones was that the junior enlisted men used to look to see what their chiefs did to get a sense of whether they wanted to stick around and have that job. The old school chiefs didn't have a particularly hard life, emphasizing the privilege of rank over obligation, but it wasn't relevant. They weren't in charge of anything. With the concept of chiefs in charge, the chiefs were working twice as hard. They needed to be out and about, being in charge of evolutions and ensuring that things went properly. They were the ones standing in front of the commanding officer explaining why things hadn't gone as well as they should have. Yet, their jobs now mattered, and the decisions they made, they actually had decisions to make, affected the lives of 135 sailors and the combat effectiveness of a $2 billion warship. This was a job people could sign up for. 2 junior officers withdrew their resignation requests. Santa Fe was awarded the Arleigh Burke Fleet Trophy. This award is given to the submarine, ship, or aircraft squadron having achieved the greatest improvement in battle efficiency during the calendar year. I attribute this to the leader-leader structure we developed on board Santa Fe. Dr. Covey told me it was the most empowered organization he'd seen anywhere, not just in the military. I was gratified to receive this recognition from a man whose work we had used to get us there. Unfettered by the mental image of leader-follower, the crew approached the business of making every evolution, every operation, excellent. At the time, we knew we were developing something new, but we didn't know what it was. Through trial and error, the crew arrived at a body of practices and principles that were dramatically more effective than those within the leader-follower model. It was only toward the end that we understood we had replaced the leader-follower model with the leader-leader model. I continued to see benefits of deliberate action. Deliberate action, first of all, reduced errors by operators and was also a mechanism for teamwork. Finally, it was a mechanism for signaling intent. A year later, at the beginning of 2001, we received the highest grade anyone had ever seen on our reactor operations examination, with top marks in every area. Afterward, I talked with the senior inspector, a captain. He told me that my guys tried to make as many mistakes as the average ship. The difference was that the mistakes never happened because of deliberate action. I didn't know it at the time, but the power of leader-leader was just starting to kick in. We had accomplished numerous other breakthroughs as well. Instead of focusing on intimate review of the work, I focused on intimate review of the people. Instead of requiring more reports and more inspection points, I required fewer. Instead of more leadership resulting in more followership, I practiced less leadership, resulting in more leadership at every level of the command. After Dr. Covey's visit, I thought long and hard about the mechanisms we had put in place and how they had worked together. I was struck that it seemed in many cases we were doing the opposite of what traditional leadership would have us do. Here are some examples. Don't do this, do this. Don't do leader-follower, do leader-leader. Don't take control, give control. Don't give orders, avoid giving orders. Don't do this. When you give orders, be confident, unambiguous, and resolute. Do this. When you give orders, leave room for questioning. Don't brief, certify. Don't have meetings, have conversations. Don't have a mentor-mentee program, have a mentor-mentor program. Don't focus on technology, focus on people. Don't think short-term, think long-term. Don't want to be missed after you depart, want not to be missed after you depart. Don't have high repetition, low quality training. Have low repetition, high quality training. Don't limit communications to terse, succinct, formal orders. Augment orders with rich, contextual, informal communications. Don't be questioning. Be curious. Don't make inefficient processes efficient. Eliminate entire steps and processes that don't add value. Don't increase monitoring and inspection points. Reduce monitoring and inspection points. Don't protect information. Pass information. Additionally, we formulated the overall construct presented here: control, competence, and clarity. Up to this point, we had just been doing stuff and seeing what worked and what didn't. I can't claim a predetermined plan, other than a vague notion that we needed to get everyone's full mental capacity, creativity, and energy involved. The mechanisms fit under the three keys in the following way. Instituting the leader-leader model. The core of the leader-leader model is giving employees control over what they work on and how they work. It means letting them make meaningful decisions. The two enabling pillars are competence and clarity. Here is a listing of the mechanisms outlined in this program. Control. Find the generic code for control and rewrite it. Act your way to new thinking. Short. Early conversations make efficient work. Use "I intend to" turn passive followers into active leaders. Resist the urge to provide solutions. Eliminate top-down monitoring systems. Think out loud, both superiors and subordinates. Embrace the inspectors. Competence. Take deliberate action. We learn everywhere, all the time. Don't brief, certify. Continually and consistently repeat the message. Specify goals, not methods. Clarity. Achieve excellence. Don't just avoid errors. Build trust and take care of your people. Use your legacy for inspiration. Use guiding principles for decision criteria. Use immediate recognition to reinforce desired behaviors. Begin with the end in mind. Encourage a questioning attitude over blind obedience. It's my hope that this organization of the mechanisms in this program will help you to put these ideas into action as you adopt the leader-leader philosophy. Here's a summary of the exercise I take organizations through when they want to move in the direction of leader-leader. First, identify where excellence is created in your company. There may be some internal processes that generate excellence, and there may be some interface processes that generate excellence. Generally, I find that interfaces with the customer and with the physical world are two key interfaces. Then, figure out what decisions the people responsible for the interfaces need to make in order to achieve excellence. Finally, understand what it would take to get those employees to be able to make those decisions. This typically requires an intersection of the right technical knowledge, a thorough understanding of your organization's goals, authority to make the decision, and responsibility for the consequences of the decision made. Questions to consider. Are you ready to take the first steps towards leader-leader? Are you ready to take the first steps toward an empowered and engaged workforce? Are you ready to embrace the changes that will unleash the intellectual and creative power of the people you work with? Do you have the stamina for long-term thinking? Chapter 28, A New Method of Resupplying. Do you want empowered employees but find that empowerment programs don't help? We learned that empowerment is not enough. Summer 2001, The Strait of Hormuz. Santa Fe was on deployment again, 18 months after Dr. Covey's visit. We'd gone through all the same inspections and pre-deployment workups as in 1999, but without much of the drama. I had a new executive officer as Lieutenant Commander Mike Bernacki relieved Lieutenant Commander Tom Stanley, and a new navigator as Lieutenant Caleb Kerr relieved Lieutenant Commander Bill Green. Lieutenant Dave Adams, Lieutenant Commander Rick Panlilio, Senior Chief Andy Warshak, and Chief David Steele were still on board. During our training period, the new officers, Bernacki and Kerr, quickly adopted the Santa Fe way of doing business. Once again, we were operating in the Strait of Hormuz at periscope depth, and we had a problem. We had just completed an operation and were anticipating a replenishment port call. It didn't look like it was going to happen. Normally, this would simply be a minor inconvenience because the submarine was loaded out for 90 days of operations at a time, and we were not close to that limit. Unfortunately, we had developed a small oil leak on a hydraulic ram that we couldn't fix at sea. Slowly but steadily, we were using up our supply of oil and were at risk of having to terminate our operation early. Up to this point, we'd had a 100% accomplishment record in terms of making our underway days and assigned missions, and I wasn't interested in losing that record now. The Strait of Hormuz is a busy place, and a submarine operating at periscope depth and slow speed has to constantly be on the lookout for traffic in each direction. As in the Strait of Malacca, supertankers are traveling in both directions. Additionally, smugglers are running from Iran across to the United Arab Emirates. And of course, fishing dhows are omnipresent. By this point in the deployment, our section tracking team had been operating smoothly, and I was not overly concerned about keeping the ship safe. I periodically looked at the displays to assure myself that we were staying clear of all traffic, but I was not paying much attention to the specific ships we were avoiding. We had an ensign on the periscope, Armando Avilés. Armando had graduated from the Naval Academy in 1999 and had reported to Santa Fe in February. He was brand new. He was enthusiastic and unconstrained by knowing how the real Navy works. This worked to our advantage. After listening to a discussion about our need for more oil, Ensign Avilés chimed in, "Hey, that's the AOE, a Navy fast resupply ship. Why don't we just ask them for some oil?" I looked at the periscope display, and sure enough, the fast combat supply ship USS Rainier was transiting through the Strait of Hormuz several miles away. The Rainier was a supply ship specifically designed with the speed to stay with the carrier battle group. It had deployed out of San Diego with the USS Constellation battle group when we departed Pearl Harbor. Rainier carried 2 million gallons of diesel fuel, 2 million gallons of jet fuel, and tons of ammunition and supplies. All we needed was a few cans of oil. Surely Rainier would have that. There was a problem. All ship movements in the carrier battle group were directed by a series of messages. One message was the Daily Intentions message, DIM. If you wanted to resupply from Rainier, you would request that it be added to the DIM. This needed to happen at least 36 hours before the planned event. One just didn't call up and get supplied. Except in this case, we did. Rainier didn't know we were there, of course, because we were remaining undetected. Even though we were in an identity condition that allowed us to be surfaced, we always practiced remaining undetected as much as possible. My thoughts were, it's a long shot, but why not? What do we have to lose? I waved the flashlight around. Go ahead, guys. See if you can set it up. I intend to break radio silence to coordinate a resupply from Rainier, said the officer of the deck. Very well. Nav called Rainier on the radio, identified who we were, and passed the Navy stock number for the external hydraulic oil. Sure enough, they would supply us. Fortunately, Captain Kendall Card, a personal acquaintance of mine, had reinforced with his crew that they were there to support the ships of the United States Navy, and that trumped bureaucracy. I'd never heard of such a thing. Not only that, but the commanding officer invited us to send over any crew members who needed medical or dental checkups beyond what Santa Fe's Doc Hill could provide. Rainier had a schedule to maintain. We couldn't delay long. If we didn't get surfaced in a few minutes, it wouldn't be able to stay around to help us. The crew sprang into action, to which I gave my immediate assent. From the sonar supervisor, Officer of the deck, I intend to retrieve the towed array in preparation for surfacing. The sonar supervisor is the chief in charge. Very well. From the officer of the deck, Captain, I intend to prepare to surface. Very well. From the chief of the boat, I intend to muster the small boat handling party in the crew's mess. I intend to break rig for dive, drain, and open the forward escape trunk lower hatch. Cobb is chief in charge. Very well. From our corpsman, Doc Hill, I intend to muster selected personnel for dental checkups in the crew's mess, conducting watch reliefs as necessary. Very well. From YN1 Scott Dillon, Captain, I intend to canvass the crew for outgoing mail and transfer it to Rainier. Very well. From the supply officer, Captain, I intend to transfer the hydraulic oil from Rainier. Very well. We surfaced for a brief stop for personnel. Meantime, Rainier lowered a small boat, loaded it, and sent it our way. The small boat they used was called a rigid hull inflatable boat, or RIB. We needed men topside and to open the main deck hatch to bring the supplies on board. Myriad various activities needed to happen quickly and in a synchronized manner. Here's where the training paid off, where everything we'd done paid off. There's no way I would have been able to pull off a plan for conducting this kind of operation and direct it piece by piece. You could call it speed of response or reducing the SENSAC delay inherent in organizations or adaptability to change. Whatever you call it, the crew's performance allowed us to continue being a submarine in defense of the country rather than limping into port for a fill-up. Not only did Rainier send the oil we needed, they sent newspapers and fresh fruits and vegetables as well. We brought the RIB alongside. We loaded the oil, newspapers, and fresh fruits and vegetables and sent half a dozen crew members over for their checkups. I was a bit concerned about our vulnerability because we were on the surface in a highly trafficked area. Consequently, we shut the hatch and prepared Santa Fe to submerge on short notice. If we had had to submerge, the group on Rainier would have been there for a couple of days. Fortunately, that wasn't necessary, and shortly thereafter, the RIB returned with our crew members. We brought them aboard and submerged, ready to operate for as long as needed now. Mechanism: don't empower, emancipate. Empowerment is a necessary step because we've been accustomed to disempowerment. Empowerment is needed to undo all those top-down, do-what-you're-told, be-a-team-player messages that result from our leader-follower model. But empowerment isn't enough in a couple ways. First, empowerment by itself is not a complete leadership structure. Empowerment does not work without the attributes of competence and clarity. Second, empowerment still results from and is a manifestation of a top-down structure. At its core is the belief that the leader empowers the followers, that the leader has the power and ability to empower the followers. We need more than that, because empowerment within a leader-follower structure is a modest compensation and a voice loss compared with the overwhelming signal that you are a follower. It is a confusing signal. What we need is release or emancipation. Emancipation is fundamentally different from empowerment. With emancipation, we are recognizing the inherent genius, energy, and creativity in all people and allowing those talents to emerge. We realize that we don't have the power to give these talents to others or empower them to use them, only the power to prevent them from coming out. Emancipation results when teams have been given decision-making control and have the additional characteristics of competence and clarity. You know you have an emancipated team when you no longer need to empower them. Indeed, you no longer have the ability to empower them because they are not relying on you as their source of power. Questions to consider. What programs have you instituted to supplement control with competence and clarity? Have you divested yourself from the attitude that you, as a corporate leader, will empower your staff? Chapter 29, Ripples. January 15th, 2011, Submarine Base, Pearl Harbor. I am sitting on the pier in Hawaii, January 15th, 2011, 12 years after I took command of the USS Santa Fe. This time, another officer is taking command, and it's Commander Dave Adams. He was coincidentally assigned to command Santa Fe after serving an executive officer tour on the USS Honolulu and commanding a provincial reconstruction team in Afghanistan for a year. He wasn't the only Santa Fe officer to do that. Lieutenant Commander Caleb Kerr also commanded a provincial reconstruction team after his tour as navigator on Santa Fe. These officers are handpicked by the Chief of Naval Operations. I don't think it was a coincidence that of the hundreds of candidates, three Navy Provincial Reconstruction Team commanders came from one ship, Santa Fe. Now, years later, I can see that implementing Leader-Leader on Santa Fe achieved two additional accomplishments that weren't immediately knowable. First, the ship continued to do well long after my departure, since we embedded the goodness of how we did business in the practices and people. That goodness persisted beyond my tenure. The ship won the award for the best chief's quarters for 7 years in a row, and won the Battle Lee Award for the most combat effective submarine in the squadron three additional times in the subsequent decade. This compares with zero during the previous decade. The other accomplishment is that we developed additional leaders in numbers widely disproportionate to the statistical probabilities. Both of the executive officers were selected to command their own submarines and were subsequently selected for major command. Both were promoted to commander and later to the rank of captain. The three eligible department heads were selected for executive officers and again to command their own submarines. They are in command now. All three were promoted to the rank of lieutenant commander, then commander, and two have already been selected for the rank of captain. The fourth department head was selected by the Navy's engineering duty officer community and was also promoted to captain. Many of the enlisted men have gone on to positions such as chief of the boat or have attained advanced degrees and run businesses. This is the power of the leader-leader structure. Only with this model can you achieve top performance and enduring excellence and development of additional leaders. If the leader-leader model can work on board a nuclear submarine, it can work for you. I worry that some listeners will think of the list of mechanisms as prescriptions that, if followed, will result in the same long-term systemic improvements we saw in Santa Fe. I don't think so. In my work as a consultant after leaving the U.S. Navy, I have discovered that each organization is different and unique. The people making up the organization have different backgrounds and a different level of tolerance for empowerment and a different sense of comfort in emancipation. Your mechanisms will be structurally similar, but the specifics will be different. For example, we found that one of the most important mechanisms for control was to change the level in the organization where an individual's vacation was approved. In your organization, it may not be the vacation policy. It may be the level at which discounts are approved for the customer. It may be the dollar amount an employee can obligate without higher authority. If you ask your people what authorities they would like in order to make their jobs easier, you'll definitely get some ideas. Deliberate action is being adopted across the submarine force. It's known to the nukes as point and shoot and taught in the nuclear power training pipeline. Many commands enforce it and take it to heart. I intend to has also been spreading. I visited the USS New Mexico, a ship commissioned in 2010. While I was talking to the captain, the duty officer walked up to him and said, "Captain, I intend to." That ship was running well. As for don't brief, certify, the language of certification as opposed to briefing has caught on within the submarine force, but for many, it's just a different word for briefing. For more information on how your organization can benefit from the leader-leader structure, I encourage you to visit my website, www.leader-leader.com, or contact me directly at david@turntheshiparound.com. On the website, I offer several tools for building a leader-leader structure, including the 7-step process for effective self-assessment that we developed on board Santa Fe. Ultimately, the most important person to have control over is yourself, for it is that self-control that will allow you to give control, create leaders. I believe that rejecting the impulse to take control and attract followers will be your greatest challenge, and in time, your most powerful and enduring success.